Hello, hello. What a wonderful showing. Thank you so much for being here tonight. My name is Aaron Brindle. I head up communications for Google Canada. Thank you to the CJF for choosing Google to host this event. It feels like an appropriate venue for a serious conversation about an issue that goes right to the heart of journalism and the news business. The future of Google and the future of news and the media business are inextricably linked. We share the same mission. I think there's a lot of people in this building that could recite by heart Google's mission, which is to organize the world's information, make it universally accessible and useful. And at the heart of that mission is a sense that is a world that is better informed, makes better decisions, which leads to better outcomes. Now, I worked at CBC for 10 years. I had the tremendous honor of working alongside Anna Maria Tremonti during that time. And I understand that organizing the world's information has always been at the heart of quality journalism, to make sense of the world by building and sharing narratives. So let me also be clear that Google doesn't always get it right. Directing users to information that is not of value, that loads too slow, that's not relevant, or that undermines trust, that's a failing on Google's part. It's not good for the user, it's not good for the news consumer, it's certainly not good for us. So building trust in news matters to Google. That is not a PR statement coming from the head of Canada PR for Google, it is an existential statement. So it's one of the reasons why I am so excited for tonight's conversation. There is little debate that building trust in news matters to everyone in this room, certainly the folks on the stage. How we get there, that's definitely worthy of a conversation, and thankfully that's what we have in store for you tonight, is a terrific conversation. So once again, welcome to Google. Enjoy the talk, and now it's my great pleasure to introduce my former boss and good friend, Anna Maria Tremonti.
Hello. Hi, everyone. We are going to talk about building trust in the media, and I don't have to remind any of you why that matters, especially these days. So we're going to ask ourselves tonight maybe how we define that, what it should look like, how to achieve it, how to combat the mistrust, and all the little nuances in between about how we move forward. You know, a lot of people hearken way back when we talk about trust. They go back to the 70s, and they talk about the days when Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America. And that's the nostalgic standard, right? And that's kind of what people still... It was 1972, by the way, very long time ago. But, you know, in fact, the truth was a little more complicated. Such a surprise. So there was an opinion poll in 1972, and an opinion research firm asked people which public figures they most trusted. Walter Cronkite did come out ahead at 73%. But it was a survey of voters in only 18 states, and he was the only newsman, and I say man because there were no newswomen, in the poll, and the rest of the people in the poll were male politicians. So after Walter Cronkite, the second place was average senator, third place was Edmund Muskie, Richard Nixon wasn't far behind. So there you go. So suddenly you get to see it a little differently. But CBS seized on this as a great marketing tool, and we've been repeating their marketing message all these years. In 1974, there was a survey on attitudes toward television newscasters. Walter Cronkite came in fourth. In 1985, he did get the highest believability rating in a Gallup poll. By then, he was off the air. So we've come a long way, maybe. And we don't just have one or two sources of news anymore, and you can't build trust by torquing one poll. So we have three people here to share their thoughts and their ideas on building trust in media. And I'll start at the far left, my far left. Craig Silverman is a media editor for BuzzFeed News. Before that, he was the editor of BuzzFeed Canada. It launched in 2015, as you likely know. He's also the founder of Emergent Info, a real-time rumor tracker that was developed as part of a fellowship with the Toe Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University. Craig previously founded Regret the Error, a blog about media accuracy and the discipline of verification. It is now part of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, and he he serves as adjunct faculty there. He was part of the team that launched OpenFile, the online news startup that delivered a community-driven reporting standard in six Canadian cities. He edited the Verification Handbook and the Verification Handbook for Investigative Journalism for the European Journalism Center. He is a former managing editor of PBS Media Shift. He's been a columnist for the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, the Columbia Journalism Review. Lots of things to ask you about tonight, Craig. Next to Craig is Richard Gingras. He is the Vice President of News at Google. He guides Google's strategies relating to the media ecosystem and oversees many of Google's news and media-related products. He was a key instigator of the recently announced Accelerated Mobile Pages project, which is an effort to make web content instantaneous, and in doing so, preserve the vitality, utility, and openness of the web. He also helped found the Trust Project. That's a global effort within the journalism community to ensure that high-quality journalism is recognized for the credibility it deserves. Richard has been involved in digital media since 1980. He actually says it was since the days of steam-powered modems. He helped found Salon.com. He's worked at Apple, At Home Network, the Excite Portal, among other digital ventures. He also serves on the boards of the First Amendment Coalition, the International Center for Journalists, and the Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard. And next to me, Hossein Derakhshan, an Iranian-Canadian writer and researcher, a pioneer of blogging in Iran. He is currently on a joint Harvard Shorenstein and MIT Media Lab fellowship. He recently co-authored the report Information Disorder, commissioned by the Council of Europe with Claire Wardle. You're going to hear more about that tonight. He spent 6 years in prison in Iran from 2008. And that experience inspired an essay on the demise of blogs and the web we have to save. His current research is focused on the theory and socio-political implications of digital and social media. So welcome, all of you. I'll just get started right away. And Hossein, I'm going to start with you because I want to talk about what you've been working on with your report with information disorder. You reframe this concept of fake news, and you talk about three categories: misinformation, disinformation, malinformation. So take us through that.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, by the way. It's good to be back in Canada after so many years, almost a decade. And it's fun to be speaking for an audience of my own Canadian compatriots. I think the information disorder, which is a term that we prefer to other alternative terms, is about basically the situation that we have different kinds of bad information, as you said, mal, mis, and disinformation. So it comes down to two ideas. One is false information, the falsity of information, and another part is the intention to harm that the creator of that information has. So when these two things overlap, you have disinformation, which is false information with the intent to harm. If you have false information without the intent to harm, that's misinformation, which usually covers mistakes by journalists or by other people. And then there are sometimes you have accurate information but used to harm somebody. And that's malinformation. This is a term we coined, and I think we needed a term for that category. Because, you know, for example, the best example is revenge porn. Revenge porn is, if it's not photoshopped, it's accurate. So, but it's the context of it has changed. It's taken from private to public in order to harm somebody. So there is always a change of context when it comes to malinformation. It's either private to public. It's either change of spatial or temporal context. You change a picture's caption, you change the date, or you change the location of that picture, and then you would use it against somebody or an organization. And this is a very common form of bad information, which is not addressed as much as the other ones. But the worry now is more about the disinformation, which is usually, which has historically been produced by rival intelligence services, by the KGB and all that, and they had really very elaborate sections working on these things. And so now, in a way, because the knowledge was sort of lost after 20 years after the Cold War, so now they're on the West, on the Western side and many other parts of the world, I think the knowledge is being reproduced again to how to resist bad information, basically, and especially disinformation.
So you have these different categories. How does it all get, how does it get amplified?
Yeah, so the problem, when we talk about all this, the problem which is new is that these disinformation and malinformation categories that are harmful can easily and cheaply be amplified. Because, you know, lies have always been around, disinformation has always been around. But since media organizations had the gatekeeper role, they wouldn't allow much of these lies and disinformation come into the wider society. But now with the new technology, and that's a change, especially with the social media, it's so easy and cheap to suddenly amplify disinformation. And that's caused the shift. And I think much of the worry comes from this fact.
And so as you went through and you kind of broke it down, what kind of conclusions did you reach about what's the most dangerous and how to identify it?
Yeah. So apart from the amplification, which can be sort of, I think, easily dealt with by platforms, there are two more sort of general problems that is also connected to the issue of trust. Maybe I would talk about them when we get more into the trust issue, which is a larger, I mean, very briefly, we've entered the post-Enlightenment era, basically, where the ideals of the Enlightenment, that were rationality and text was a huge part of, at the center of the Enlightenment movement, and many of the achievements in science and technology started from that detachment from feelings and emotions and prejudices. I think we've entered a new era, which I'll talk later more about, which makes it more difficult to fight disinformation, lies, and these things, because we're not talking about facts anymore. People are relating to them as faith, and that's a really big shift and not easy to address and to fight. So I would prefer to talk about it later when we get into trust.
Sure.
Well. But then one other aspect, which is also new, is how consumption of news for the first time has become a public act. That's also new. That's also something that make all of these things much more difficult. Because previously, if you read a newspaper or if you watched TV or you listened to radio, unless you did it in your family, nobody else would do what you were doing. So your behavior would be much more diverse. You would take risks. You would sometimes read the newspaper that doesn't necessarily reflect your opinion. You know, that diversity, I think, is shrinking because every time you read or do or see anything, because of the social media dynamics, other people can see it and it's become a public act, and I think it's damaging.
Excuse me. Craig, can you pick up on that, just that public act, like maybe sort of from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an element of, like, why do we share things on social media? We share things because we're often trying to convey something about ourselves. We're trying to say, you know, convey us as, well, I'm sharing this New Yorker article, you know, look, I read this journal, I identify with this. And so that performative aspect can be great. It could have good incentives in some ways of, you know, I want to appear as a very, you know, well-read and intelligent person. But what I also see a lot in my research and reporting is particularly on Facebook, whereas, you know, people are really kind of performing for their side, especially when we get into the political realm. And as it relates to trust, like, one of the things that starts to raise is people get to the point where the stuff that they trust the most is stuff that aligns with their view of the world, their personal opinions, the stuff that makes them feel good when they see it and reinforces what they believe, which is a totally natural human characteristic. That's not new. But the ability to really gorge yourself on that and then kind of portray that out and build a following and gain attention and status from that, these are factors that can be corrupting in some ways for the average person. And I think in some cases, people don't even realize the effect that it's kind of had on them. And you know, I did a story this week about a woman who started a Tea Party group in the United States in Houston. You know, several years ago when the Tea Party movement was really starting up there, was really involved in conservative politics, ran for like her local GOP, you know, head of her local GOP group. And she's now, she realized that so many of the people in her circle were sharing stuff that was just not true, that she now has given up political activism, and she runs a Facebook page called Unfakery, where she tries to teach people how to actually spot this stuff. Which is like, it's a great example, because they may actually trust her more because she's in their in-group, and there's a lot of research that backs that up. You know, the danger is, of course, you get people who won't engage as much with journalism because it's disagreeing with them. And this is, I think, a danger that a lot of folks in the media especially are worried about, that do we get to a point where the common set of facts are gone, and it's, you know, my side and your side, that space in the middle of rational debate starts to collapse because I can gorge myself on what I want and I get reinforced by that. And so that's where some of the public pieces, I think, start to have potentially really negative incentives.
Richard, how does Google fit into that? As you listen to these guys, what are you thinking?
Well, I think as we all know, we live in a dramatically different world. As I frequently say, the internet put a printing press in everyone's hands. And that's been an extraordinary thing. On one hand, it's created a richness of knowledge and information that people around the world can access, the likes of which we haven't seen in the history of civilization. It also obviously creates opportunities, as always the case with free expression, for people to use it for nefarious purposes, right? So interestingly, you can look at the internet as, you know, in the United States, as the First Amendment brought to life, but part of that means also accepting that there will be information out there that each of us in our own way are uncomfortable with. So that raises, obviously, really compelling challenges as to, you know, how do our institutions evolve to address that? How does the institution of the press evolve to do that? And from a standpoint of Google, for instance, with Google Search, Google News, against the platform of the open web, is how do we appropriately exercise our responsibility in helping people guide people to the right kinds of information? Which I should point out is a particular challenge because, you know, we don't think it's appropriate, and I don't think many other people do either, for Google, for instance, through Google Search, to be the ultimate decider of what is acceptable or unacceptable expression, or what is true and what is not true, right? That would be a very, very dangerous step. And in fact, as I point out, particularly in this environment, keep in mind, often, you know, we'll surface a bad result, and it's guaranteed we will surface nefarious information, depending on how you search for it. And often there'll be criticism of us in that regard. Which in some cases is appropriate, in some cases not. What I feel I always have to point out to folks is Google Search is a tool which appropriately should let you find anything that's findable in the corpus of legal expression, including in the darkest corners of expression, not just the light corners of expression. It's important as a society that we get to know that that's there. It's hugely important to the craft of journalism that we get to know that that stuff is there. So, you know, how we evolve our craft at both how we do that, how we give users appropriate guides to what they're seeing, is something that we have and will continue to work on. And I could go on for a long time about that. But as you know, I mean, in part of our effort has been, what can we do as an institution in this environment to both help guide the evolution of the other institutions like journalism? How do we guide, how might we help with the evolution of frameworks that help people understand what they're seeing, which, you know, clearly was the reason for the instigation of the Trust Project 4 years ago, right? How does the journalism community rethink itself in terms of guiding people about signals of who they are in what they're doing such that I can have a better sense of determining what's good and what's bad? You know, again, we can't overstate the fact that, back 40 years ago, there was an extraordinarily limited corpus of information, you know, and we all read the magazines and the newspapers our families read. Now, there are a billion websites today, right? It's a maelstrom of expression. So it's a very, very, very different environment. And it is intrinsically, which is, again, one of the things we need to both understand and to some degree accept, is intrinsically divisive. I mean, to your point, if you want to unify a society, then you have single-run government-owned media. Kim Jong-il tells you what to think and believe. Yes, in the 70s, there's the meme, which you accurately point out is maybe less than truthful, is that we had three major television networks in the United States, and we had Uncle Walter Cronkite. Now you get a billion websites. Again, it's intrinsically divisive. I mean that in a mathematical sense, not in the sense of confrontation. It is just that. And so that's why, you know, how do we evolve what we do as an industry as an ecosystem of journalists, as an industry of publishers, as a participant in that ecosystem with a very significant and responsible role to help evolve that in a better place? No silver bullets here. There's a lot of work that has to be done, and I think there is very good work being done. But this is not going to, there's no solution here that's going to happen overnight.
You know, I was thinking about how we know how much technology changes the, like, journalism and how we look at what's going on in an analysis. But Craig, I was thinking as well that, you know, we didn't have live stream fact-checking that many years ago. Like, that's been an effort to actually confront the truth through the new technology that we have. But it also speaks to how journalistic organizations try to get ahead of all these changes.
Yeah, but there's, I mean, at the core of it, that's a great example of, so live, someone's giving a speech, you know, the president gives a State of the Union, and they're trying to live fact check it. That can work for a really big unifying event like that, and also where the text of what the president is going to talk about has a certain element of predictability. You might expect maybe they'll talk about unemployment, maybe they're going to talk about the debt, areas where maybe you've got a corpus of fact checks that have already been made by you and other people. So you can sort of predict the text and you can deal with it in real time, but you take that kind of solution or that approach out of that context into ones where you fundamentally don't know what people are going to say, where they're dealing with facts and claims that you can't predict in any way, shape, or form, and it's absolutely impossible to do that. And so we have, at the core of all of this stuff that we're talking about, we have this massive scale problem where, on the benefit, more voices, easier for anyone to publish, easy for anyone to interact, great democratic things, also unleashing completely new challenges to democracy, to information consumption, to all the fundamental ways that we interact with facts and information on a daily basis. And so you have companies like Google who are trying to organize that, but inevitably the choices that are made in how it's organized and what's valued over something else does actually, you know, create winners and losers, just like Facebook valuing certain things with its algorithms to what gets shown in newsfeed creates winners and losers. And so for me, I mean, I have a bias that I'll declare, which is that I basically wake up every day and I look at all, and I try to find people who are abusing these systems and who are trying to game the systems. And so that's all I see all day long is people doing that. And it's very profitable for them. And it's profitable in one way because of that scale piece, that they can sort of hide within these very large, you know, ecosystems and platforms and get away with stuff for long enough before somebody kind of notices. And so at the core of it is really just this fundamental challenge of how do we actually manage that scale of information? And it's also a human challenge because we're not used to dealing with that amount of information overload coming from that many sources, mediated by friends, institutions, all these other things. I think it's a huge challenge, frankly, for humanity and for society right now. So we shouldn't be surprised that a small piece of that is a big challenge around maintaining and building trust for journalists, yeah. Right? There's massive things going on beyond that, for sure.
Richard, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I think fact checks is an interesting example of both how do we evolve new journalistic forms, and how do we create mechanisms that allow the organism of the ecosystem of the web to, in a sense, theoretically heal its own problems. We were deeply involved with the creation of the fact check ecosystem starting some 4 years ago, based on the notion of could we stimulate and enable organizations who could do independent modules of fact checks that could be surfaced in context of a search query. So to give you an example of what I mean, you know, as I said earlier, you can find bad information. If you do a query on Google search today for peach pits as a cancer cure, I guarantee you, you will find results on the first page that says, yes, it does, and maybe even someone who's willing to sell you the powdered form. Okay, fine. And it doesn't happen to be a recent fresh article from the Toronto Globe and Mail or from the New England Journal of Medicine saying, by the way, it doesn't. And so we created the fact-check structures such that publishers of various sorts, including the scientific community, could take their existing archive of information and structure it in a way such that we could identify it and surface it in context, right? So again, no silver bullets, but I think that's an interesting approach. You know, and some folks say, well, yeah, but fact checks, you know, if affirmation wins out over information, am I going to believe the fact check? Depends on the context. You know, one thing about Google search is it's very different from a social context where you're much less inclined to be corrected about something you just shared. But people come to search asking search questions that they would likely be embarrassed to admit to their spouses, right? They wouldn't want to admit that they don't know the answer to the question. And so we recognize that people approach search results in a different way and are more open to assessing various sources of information and coming to a conclusion. So again, I'm not saying there are any magic bullets here, but that is an example of how can we evolve the architectures of content, journalistic content, quality content in this ecosystem such that we can begin to address these problems in different ways.
And we're talking about the fact check, and all of this, though, still requires a level of critical thinking on the part of the person who's absorbing this information. And Hussein, you made a point. There's facts, and then there's faith. So sometimes, like, there's more going on here in the psyche of an individual.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So I just want to talk about some a theory in communication studies, which is very helpful here. You know, there is one approach to think about media and communication, which has been the dominant form of analysis, which is called the transmission model. It's a very famous form, which deals with how a message is transferred from A to B, and all the dynamics and the mechanics and different aspects of this. So trust in this model has a different meaning, and then it would have another meaning in another model, in the second model, which complements this aspect, which is called a ritual model. And it's a very interesting, more recent development. I think James W. Carey invented the term, and he's written on it extensively, maybe not as much as you know, the transmission model, because it's more recent and newer and younger. But basically what he means is that there is another aspect to media which is more like religion, which is more like joining a club. So when you read a newspaper, you're not just reading that newspaper in order to be informed. You want to belong to a group of people who share that worldview. You want to be part of the drama that is being transferred and conveyed and conducted by different elements, different forces in the world. You would see yourself, you would sympathize with one side, and you picture them and you want them to win. So there is a dramatic ritual aspect to news and communication and media, which is less thought about than written about. And trust, when it comes to this model or this paradigm, would have a completely different meaning, because it's not about rationality. It wouldn't be about you know, fact checks and these things, and it would be more about faith and emotions. And I think increasingly, since in a civilizational shift, I think, for many reasons, the collapse of welfare states, rising inequality, the collapse of maybe public education systems in many parts of the world, the decline of public broadcast and publicly funded media, all these things have led to a situation where we have a big bunch of people, maybe a big chunk of the middle class even, that is not as rational as it used to be, and they are also even encouraged by the media environment, by the social media especially. Just think about this, for example, that, you know, the other alternative to liking things on Facebook, they could have had agree or disagree. They could have had, you know, trust or suspect. The fact that all your reactions on social media is about showing emotions and likes, this talks about a shift. This is a civilizational shift, even to a degree. So I think this aspect should help us to redefine trust from a ritual model. And then when it comes to that approach, I think trust should be redefined, should be looked at in a whole different way, which I think would not be about accuracy, impartiality, and fairness, which is the main three dominant principles of all, you know, respect objective media. And it would be about other things that are more like religion, that are more about personal connection, more about things that, you know, this is, I think, explains why people can still think that climate change is not true, or, you know, many other things. When people reject very scientifically proven facts, because this is not a realm of rationality and facts. This is a different realm that we haven't really studied well enough yet.
Yeah. Who wants to pick up on that?
Well, I agree with just about everything you're saying. I do think trust is indeed based on faith and emotion. And I think the challenge and, in a sense, the opportunity is again, how do we evolve our architectures to help people get that better sense, right? I mean, that was what you said was buttressed completely by some of the research that we did as part of the Trust Project, right? They make their determination of trust based on a lot of factors, including who's that individual behind the article, right? So, and that, by the way, just because I don't think we've gone into it, is that really is the underpinnings of the Trust Project. It's not about somebody saying you're trusted and you're not. It's about can we encourage greater degrees of transparency about the source, such that people have a better ability to form that conclusion. You know, you go to too many sites today, even legitimate high-quality news sites, where, you know, you can't find, like, well, who's behind the site? Who's the editor? Who's the managing editor? Who's the publisher? Who owns the publication? More information about the author, more information about the body of their work. Maybe on important stories, citations that give me an indication of why that reporter reached the conclusion they reached. So, you know, here too, can we create that, in a sense, fabric of signals that help people form that better conclusion about what they're seeing? One thing that we found, and you know, again, the Trust Project started 4 years ago, well before the, quote, all the dust about fake news. But, you know, the Trinity Mirror publishing company in Europe, Trinity Mirror, implemented all the recommendations of the Trust Project. And what they found, they've been constantly measuring the perception of trust of the publication, was within like 3 or 4 months, the perception of trust went up 8%. The willingness of the reader to recommend the publication to others went up 8%, because they're providing better clues and signals to the user to make that assessment. Again, one step. Now, we see that as extraordinarily valuable from a search engine perspective, because we want to see more of those signals, right? So much of what we do with search is based on an understanding of authoritativeness, of expertise. And God knows we could use a whole lot better signal about that to help make these determinations. You know, I would much rather, for instance, bias the rankings towards not just a reporter who has, you know, who we know is from a respected domain, but I would rather bias it towards the reporter who's on that beat, you know, who has expertise in that subject, right? That's hugely beneficial to us. And so that's the thrust of what we're looking to do, is how do we create this architecture of trust, this fabric of trust, such that both consumers and key components like search engines, like social networks, can do a better job of filtering the good from the bad and everything that's in between, because it's everything but binary.
And how do we do that on a practical daily level, Craig, when we've got like all these demands for journalists to actually get out there and do this stuff and then put it in there and be transparent? And like, how do you even begin to change the way you work in order to do all that?
I think one, so there's a couple things that come out of this that, that relate to that. And the short answer, I think, is that actually there's some stuff that individual journalists might be expected to do, but to be honest, what Richard is talking about is actually trying to, in a sense, automate it in some ways. So, you know, you have a byline, you have a bio, you work for a certain organization, that organization has a statement of ethics and a corrections policy on its website. All of that gets encoded in ways that search engines and, you know, Facebook's algorithms can actually see that, oh, this is a site that has these things here being displayed for all of its content. We might weight that more against other things. And so yes, it's true that journalists are also being asked to be on social media, to engage with the audience, to have human interaction with people. But there's also this movement now of trying to deal with that scale problem I talked about, of saying, how do we actually demonstrate these things in a way that can actually be interpreted in by machines? Which is, frankly, it's an inevitable thing we have to deal with. But the other piece of that that sort of makes it worthwhile, but also raises other questions, is what Richard is talking about, of saying, well, I would rather weight the beat reporter more than others. And that is these platforms saying, we will make decisions about certain things over other things. And that is a reality. And I think the trend, we've gone from this place where a lot of the platform companies had said, look, we're an even playing field. We do our best to organize and judge based on it. We use human signals, we use other signals. We're trying to be a level open playing field. I think we're actually moving away from that to a much more controlled universe where the thumbs are getting put on the scale a bit more. And I do think that established media will benefit from that. The risk, of course, is, well, what stuff gets knocked out unintentionally, not necessarily trying to censor people, but what happens unintentionally. And so those are two trends we're seeing. One is there's absolutely not just the Trust Project, but the Credibility Coalition and others trying to encode these signals so that machines can recognize them. And then the second is that I think the platforms are saying, all right, we recognize that there have been downsides to this kind of perception of level playing field. Let's see what we can do in a way to value certain things that is not as controversial as us sort of saying, I like you, I don't like you, but actually taking signals that are open to everyone. So this is sort of where
right.
we're going.
And I agree, but I want to clarify a bit. I mean, obviously the Google search algorithm is making judgments every day and has been for its entire existence. And we would never deny that. I think the question for us is, how do we evolve our systems and approaches to do that in a better and better way? And do it in a way that's organic. You know, one of my big fears in this current environment, I spend a lot of time around the world. I have a global job. And I spend a lot of time in public policy environments, whether it's Brussels or Jakarta.
You poor guy.
And, yeah, well.
Paying fines.
And what concerns me is this, is that the notion of fake news, which, as you've said, is a huge spectrum of stuff, is being used in parts of the world to impose regulations that, in the end, will constrain free speech. And that's really dangerous. You know, and for instance, I've had even well-meaning organizations come to us and say, well, how about if we rate all the news organizations and tell you who's good and who's bad? And I go, no. No, I mean, at least by my understanding of free expression and the First Amendment, you know, the whole idea of the First Amendment is you don't need a license to be a journalist. So we don't want to go in that direction. You know, I had an encounter when I was in Brussels recently with a member of parliament from an Eastern European country talking about fake news. We were together for about 45 minutes. And it was a very interesting discussion. I thought it was very positive until about the final 8 minutes, where it became clear what their real objective was. The real objective was that person was very good at controlling the traditional media in her country. To her. Now you can narrow it down to about 100.
Start Googling, everyone.
Start Googling. What she really wanted to do was clamp down on the bloggers. She wanted to clamp down on the independent journalists because they were the one who were actually doing, in many regards in these countries, the real serious work. So, you know, that to me is the true unfortunate consequence of the environment we're in, is that free expression is under attack, democracy is under attack, and there's a ton of work to do there because I find even in educated societies, even in my own country, the knowledge and acceptance of our constitutional constructs is not there. And that's terrifying, including lots of people who should know better. So I you know, I come at this with a tremendous amount of trepidation in terms of how we approach it.
We're going to open this up to questions. There's a microphone over there, but I'll just get, as we wait for people to get up there. But then we get back to the issue of trust. We get back to if you're trying to sort through the different kinds of disinformation and weight it a little bit, then there's still a trust that you have to be trusted to do that. So how do we build that? Like, I know there's, as you said, there's no silver bullet here, but that's the, because the people who are also putting out the other things are trusted, right? They're trusted by the people who want to believe what they believe, the people whose faith is, you know.
Yeah, I think we should also maybe reformulate the question of trust, because I think there is always a trust somebody or something as something, and we actually don't talk about the as part. So by that I mean I can trust somebody as my friend, but not as my business partner or my life partner. I can trust somebody or an organization to do one specific thing that I don't even necessarily agree with. So for instance, I trust the Wall Street Journal to reflect a certain opinion. I still trust them, but what matters is as what. And this is a very important distinction and a question that I think we have to talk about, because if we, for example, scientifically measure how people trust different media, I think you would reach a conclusion that everybody trusts their own favorite media. Everybody trusts their own favorite people. So it wouldn't take us anywhere, just the general, very, you know, decontextualized question of trust. So once you see that the people who watch Fox News trust it as much as the people who read the New York Times, for example, then we would maybe have to reformulate this question as we need to create trust for objective journalism,
yes,
or for rational thinking or for public institutions, you know, to do that certain thing that they were made for. Just because, you know, people trust something less or more, it doesn't take us anywhere. So I just think that the question is not right enough yet.
That's great.
Craig, how do we do that?
So I think one of the challenges we have is a lot of times trust, if we talk about the media, there was a real human piece to it. We would see journalists in our community. We would have a connection with something that we knew was of our community. And now that's kind of been taken away in a lot of ways. We know that local media is struggling perhaps more than any other type in Canada and other places. And so I think a part of it is figuring out how do we use this new technology to actually kind of recreate some of that element of the human connection and the human trust that was there, which I think is one of the reasons why so many journalists are trying to engage with people on social media or being told to get out on social media and engage with people. It's because, well, that's where people are now. Whatever your beat is, you may not have a geography for it. So, you know, for someone like me working for a larger organization, I try to build a community on Twitter and other places. And so I think the technical signals piece is important. I think the piece of journalists figuring out how do I create human interaction in ways where maybe I don't get to go see people in person as much. And then for the organizations themselves is who is our community and how do we build that around us, which I think goes to Hossein's point of like what should they be trusting us as, mm-hmm, who is our audience? And so organizations figuring out what that audience looks like and trying to engage with them, and frankly I think for a lot of organizations now trying to get money from them as subscribers, that potentially builds a relationship there that can start to build trust. When people give you money, there's something, yes, that's really powerful there. And I say that working for a place that has no paywall and probably, you know, as far as I see right now, we'll never have a paywall. And so we have a different challenge of that. We need to get people to install our apps. We need to get them to create a relationship with us where we can engage with them every single day and have them, you know, love our newsletter or love the app or something like that and kind of build from there. So, you know, a lot of this is like reformulating signals that were there that were often like one-to-one human signals or very community-based signals.
Yeah, there's so much one could say there. You know, again, I think all of our institutions, including ourselves, need to rethink how we approach these things. I often point out that Google search, in a sense, is in the trust business, right? The switching cost from one search engine to another is nil, right? So we earn your trust every day. And in certain regards, and I think in many regards, we do a really good job. But I also find experiences where, you know, we need to here too evolve our thinking. You know, and sometimes I say it's like we're the victims of our own success. If you asked Google, how tall is Jim Comey? We'll say 6'9". How tall is Theresa May? 5'9". That's great. We know those answers. But obviously, for so many questions, there is no singular answer. You know, so our general approach is, our philosophy is, like, how do we, on any of those queries, give people the tools and information they need to develop their own critical thinking and hopefully come away with a more informed conclusion? But that's obviously a very tricky challenge. You know, one of the things I've been saying in general about news organizations and about Google, we talk a lot about media literacy. Well, can we not put focus on how we develop news products, how we evolve our search product, such that in a sense it teaches media literacy as you use it? You know, how carefully can you label things? It annoys me to no end when you do a news, when you do a search query on a news item on Google, and the first article that comes back in the carousel is an opinion piece. But I don't know until I click through, right? That to me is not the right result. You know, so how do we convey better signals? You know, a UX designer at Google mentioned to me recently, he says, I wish we could put in an indication somewhere on the Google search results that says anything below this line, you know, buyer beware, reader beware, clicker beware. But I laughed, but there is an element of validity to that. I don't know what the answer is, but that's why I think all of us need to, in our own way, from where we work, again, search engine, news product, really think, how do we convey what we do, how we do it, why we do it, such that we might get to that better place?
Got a question here. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Monica. I'm from Ottawa. Thank you so much to the Foundation for organizing this. It's fascinating. I wanted to scroll back to the beginning of the conversation when we were talking about the concept of global trust. And I've heard a couple of references tonight to the First Amendment to the United States, which has to do with freedom of expression. Of course, in Canada, our First Amendment says we have all sorts of rights, but they're all subject to reasonable limits. So we start from the premise, you're not free to do everything, there are going to be limits, so watch out. And then our second article of the Constitution speaks to freedom of expression. So when I hear you talking about, or not you personally, yeah, but the discussion about thumbs on the weigh scale, whose thumbs in a global world, and how do you reconcile that with national sovereignty?
You want to take that one?
It's a very good question. And again, we do everything possible in the design of our systems to make sure there are no thumbs on the scale, because I think that is the worst. We don't want to go there. And so we keep trying to come up with other methods. Let me give you an example. The search engine algorithm is based on two characteristics, relevance and authority. Right? Relevance is simply, does the document match the query? If you ask Google, what's that movie? It was an island and a volleyball. And we instantly come back and say, oh, Castaways. Right? Seems like magic. We don't, by the way, understand the word volleyball or island. We just did the watch matches. That's relevance. Authority. How do we develop a sense of authority? There are lots of signals that go into that, but the core foundation of it today is a mechanism that is 10,000 plus evaluators around the world. So when we make algorithm changes, we give them sets of queries with here are the former results and here are the current results, and give them detailed guidelines as to how to assess them. Right? Tell us what we're getting wrong, what we're getting right. And by the way, there is a 160-page public document on Google that is the guidelines that those raters use. So if you want to understand, in a sense, what are our policies underlying authority, you can effectively find it there. But there's no individual thumb on the scale. It's 10,000 raters and hundred thousands of data points that help us understand, on this kind of query, yeah, that New York Times article was perfect. As a woodworker, my query on a table saw best answered by the blogger who has the same one, right? These things vary in context. So, I mean, I think that's key, is how do we evolve both our approaches to understanding authority, how do we be as transparent as possible as our approaches can be, such that, again, we gain that trust. Because the last place I think we want to be or anyone would want us to be is making that determination, is putting that thumb on the scale.
I wonder, as we wait for another question, I wonder how much what we choose to cover also helps trust.
Or hurts.
Well, I want to ask Craig, like for BuzzFeed mm-hmm. in particular, I remember when you started really kicking some ass in Ottawa, right? Like the story's right. starting to come out. And so, you know, you look at it, you go, oh, who's that? What did right. they, which story did they break? And then, you know, Washington, what did they get? Like, so like the choice of hard news, frankly, hard political news, mm-hmm. in the choices of what we put out there and where we put our resources as journalists. How, just want yeah. to speak to that?
Yeah, well, so two pieces of that. One is that if you look at all the research that's been done around kind of trust and that element of it, people are often very critical of what is not being covered or how things are being covered. So those are two pieces that absolutely formulate people's perceptions of a given outlet or of the media as a whole. And there are always things to complain about in those areas, for sure, legitimate complaints. You know, the trust piece is really weird when it comes to BuzzFeed because the company started, I guess it was like 12 years ago, had nothing to do with journalism or news. It was just what do people share, what spreads, and they ended up over time that things like lists and quizzes and videos of people trying foods from different places and that kind of stuff. And then 6 years ago, they started a news organization. And I was like, well, why the hell are you doing that? And how can these two things fit together? And people still say that. It's 6 years later. And I can tell you that, like, one of the things, people in the news division, whenever we get the CEO or someone and we have a chance to talk to them, literally it's asked every time just to check in on him and be like, you still like news? What's going on with you? You know, like, and but the reason that they talk about, and this is why trust is so difficult sometimes, is for them, they realize that people consume a lot of news online. If we're going to be big, we need to have news. So that's like an obvious kind of description. But the one that's harder to put your finger on relates to trust, which is that they sort of realize that, well, if we wanted to work with really big clients and to, you know, have to get bigger deals and to be perceived as, you know, a worthy and interesting and good partner on the business side, news was a way to build trust with advertisers and brands, which sounds so weird because they don't want to be anywhere near news when they're advertising. But that was the thing that they kept hearing, was that, you know, that prestige, that sense of trust, that social impact, brands don't want their ads next to it, but they actually want to be associated with it, which is like a weird combination, and it's impossible to actually quantify that. But it's one of the reasons that I think BuzzFeed has news today, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what a strange turn of events that is, in a way, right?
It's very encouraging, actually.
It may be, yes, hopefully. I mean, this is, you know, I see more investment in news than when I started at the company 3 years ago. And we now have more than 300 journalists around the world in the news part, and we're separate from the entertainment part. But, you know, I also know that for us, the trust piece, I think one of the challenges is that there are some people who it may take years or decades for them to trust BuzzFeed News because they think of BuzzFeed as the videos and the quizzes. Yeah. And so that's our challenge as an organization. Whereas other organizations that started in news and have, you know, over time, there's perceptions and hardened perceptions of them have been built up in a different way. That's what they have to deal with. So everyone's got their challenge.
If I might jump in on that. Because here, too, I think these are areas where we need to kind of step back and give further thought as to how we do what we do. And again, I speak for ourselves. I speak for, I think, in a sense, how news organizations can as well. I do think there is an issue of disproportionality of coverage. You know, an example I frequently cite these days is, like, you know, last year when there's the parliamentary attack in London, you know, the cable news networks in the United States went wall to wall for 3 days. Now, it was a sad event. 4 people died. On each of those 3 days in the United States were mass murders of 4 or more people that did not get covered, right? And so to what extent are we in also fueling people's fears, right? People going to the polls, living in a farming community in Iowa, more worried about terrorism, but not having any understanding of what the real issues are in their community. Now, here, too, I think the technological environment, the tools available to us can help. Can we make greater use of data journalism to put things into context, right? such that I understand, yes, there was a home invasion that happened, but by the way, that's the first home invasion that's happened in 5 years. Or by the way, there were five in the last month as a problem here, right? So, you know, one of the things that I'm optimistic about, given I think the shift, particularly at the local news level, of models that are much more oriented towards membership and subscription, and I am very optimistic there, is can that free them up from being so driven by page view engagement? And create these mechanisms to, in a sense, help their communities understand what's important or not. The metaphor I've been using is, you know, can you give me a weather report of my community that goes beyond the meteorological, that tells me the key metrics of my community, like the crime rate, like the air quality index, like the graduation rate from schools, to help me understand what's important and not. And at Google, we're trying to reflect that as well. We're just about to launch something. We're trying to figure out how can we make it easier for people when do a query and say crime rate in my town, that we actually can pop back a chart that gives them the data and not just a sea of results that take me 10 minutes to find the data, right? So how do we, what can we do to help people find, give a sense of context beyond the anecdote? I mean, the anecdote stories in journalism are what drives it, and that's powerful and that's good. But without context, it can be extraordinarily dangerous, I think, as we see in our world today.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Max. I'm a web developer for Global News. And I'm curious, how do you engineer a system that validates and builds trust around blogs and quality freelance journalism and doesn't just prop up the big guys? For example, like, you know, at the organization I work at, we have come across several of these initiatives to engender trust. For example, Facebook rolled out a breaking news banner that you could attach to your articles. And typically, these, just speaking candidly, these initiatives tend to benefit our own organization for a couple reasons. One, because there's the we have the technical expertise and time to implement these solutions. And two, we just find that when large platforms roll out these initiatives, they tend to typically want to pair with large, big media organizations. So is there room in this framework for the little guy, for bloggers or freelance journalism? Or is that sort of just kind of an unfortunate side effect of rolling out these systems?
No, well, if we're doing our job right, that's absolutely what we should be doing. And that's frankly what we're trying to do and what I'm trying to do. And let me give you a sense of that, because frankly, that's that that resonates so powerfully with me, right? You know, one thing I've said about our own systems, as I said, expertise matters. I don't feel we have sufficient understanding of expertise of individual voices. Right? It's not necessarily just about the domain, it's about the voice. You know, when I ran Salon, Glenn Greenwald was there working with me, and when I left, he went on to The Guardian, then he went on to The Intercept. Our systems don't have a good understanding of Glenn Greenwald as someone who has particular expertise in issues of national surveillance, right? It would be good for our systems to evolve that capability. Another example, about 2 years ago, Ezra Klein, Vox.com, came to Google. He had just founded it. And I said, thanks for coming to Google. And he says, why wouldn't I come to Google? I have no Google juice because Vox.com was brand new. And I went, well, like, that's unfortunate because, you know, it seems to me the reputation of a domain, of a brand, is the sum total of the reputations of the authors there. And Ezra Klein had a good 12 years of good reputation and experience in political coverage, right? So you're absolutely correct. You know, that's why I get nervous when we talk about, you know, do we kind of shift towards, in a sense, the more known sources? The known sources aren't necessarily the right sources. We have to go more broadly than that. We have to understand it more deeply than that.
Hussein, have you got thoughts on that, given your blogging genesis?
Yeah, I think actually one of the problems when it comes to all this is that, as Richard was saying, that many oppressive governments would try to use this whole worry about disinformation as a pretext to stifle free speech. I think one maybe better approach would be to think about how we can regulate algorithms, not speech. Because, you know, first of all, even the idea of First Amendment, which is about free expression, there are some people suggesting that we should maybe even rethink that, because when for the first time in history, everybody can have a voice. Yet, much of these voices are not heard because of these technologies and the algorithms. Is it still true that we can all express ourselves? Is it really free expression when nobody listens to you, when you don't have an audience? Is that really free expression? Is that really free speech? So I think this is another question that we have to reformulate about, you know, how certain kinds of algorithms are censoring people the way that, very similar to the way that governments, for example, used to censor people. So I've been thinking about this approach about regulating algorithms instead of regulating content, which is some sort of regulation or legislation proposals. I would love to have your opinion on this, although Google still belongs to the Enlightenment era because it deals with text and thinking and rationality. I mean, apart from the YouTube, which I think would be taking over the whole Google in a few years. But anyways, what was I saying? Yeah, I would love to hear your opinion about how, is it possible? I mean, what do you think about the idea of forcing platforms, not just platforms, devices even, self-driving cars, every technological tool, to allow third-party algorithms, to allow a whole new market of people who would create algorithms based on different values, different, you know, mechanisms, different ideals, and people would have a choice not to use that device, but to which algorithms they would want to use their self-driving car to use, or search engine, or, you know, social news feed, or, you know, TV even, or YouTube, for example, because there are all these algorithms are not none of them are neutral. They're all based on certain social values. So, for instance, much of these algorithms now are based on the social value of popularity. Popularity is at the core of much of what we are exposed to. Whereas you would think that if instead of popularity, you had diversity as the dominant value on many of these algorithms, you would have a completely different output from all these, you know, platforms, Google, Facebook, and all that. What do you think about this?
Look, I do think that obviously algorithms are all over the place today, right? In places we don't even know that there are algorithms running. So it's a very, very valid question to ask. You know, when someone uses the word regulation, I always say, like, okay, let's be careful what we say and what we mean, because that can be equally dangerous. So, you know, we, in a sense, having recognized this issue years ago, have very much evolved how we approach things, particularly with regard to transparency, right? How do we convey more about what we do and how we do it? That 160-page document is hugely important, right? As I say about Google search, we show our work every day. The results for every query that we get every day are there for people to analyze. And people do analyze them with machines. They should. So it depends what one means. Because on the other hand, when people say, well, I've had people say, oh, the algorithm should be transparent. And I go, well, really? Because that opens up just vectors of security, where people are already gaming the algorithm, and they'll game it doubly. And by the way, in the world of machine learning, it's so complex, no one would really be able to figure it out. So what is one saying? When one says, you know, do you want the government to decide what the algorithm is? It's like, who decides? So I don't think it's regulation at that level. I do think, you know, if in an enlightened world, we could say, you know, thou shalt be algorithmic transparency, and here's what that means, in terms of principles, you know, can there be ways for people to, in a sense, third parties to audit algorithms, including like search in a sense is easy because, as I say, we show the results every day on every query. But in other environments, recommendation environments, I was having a conversation last night, a couple of nights ago in San Francisco about, you know, could one develop, in a sense, panels of users in, say, a social network environment, in a YouTube environment, where third parties were assessing what the algorithm was doing such that it could be analyzed and critiqued. I think that's very valid. So I just, you know, can we come up with enlightened approaches to help people understand algorithms and be comfortable as a society with what's going on? Yes. But getting to the point of the government deciding what the algorithm is, or that's obviously dangerous territory for all the things, reasons I think we know.
I want to keep you guys to time, and we've got one person there waiting for a question. I think that's going to be our last question for the evening.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
My name is Melisant. I'm in PR. And so one of the things I have to do with the people that I work with is make sure that they're very careful in what they say, because one of the first lessons in PR is you can't predict crazy, especially when it comes to social media. So I just wanted to turn the idea of trust around. One of the things I've noticed is the backlash or the angry mob against journalists. And there have been some recent examples of death threats against journalists who've had very... The opinions aren't so controversial that you would expect them to be getting death threats. One was with the an opinion piece about the Broncos and fundraising and pictures and stuff. Anyway, I was just wondering if you guys had any thoughts on this idea of trust when it comes to journalists and being able to express themselves in the context of where the world's at right now in social media.
Who wants to... tackle that?
I think one of the sort of online mobbing that people kind of talk about, and one of the reasons why journalists sometimes are the target of it is that, you know, we do have status on these platforms. We're typically verified. We tend to have a larger audience. We're attached to sometimes large brands. Although that wasn't really the case of Nora, who the journalist I think you were referring to, and so. The prominence that's there creates that scenario, but it's also really important. I think, you know, something that I've seen with our team at BuzzFeed here in Toronto is it's very different from one journalist to the next. So, are you a person of color? Are you a woman? What do you tend to cover? You put any combination of those things together, and it's vastly different. I get very little online abuse. Sachi Cole, one of our writers who writes a lot about gender issues and other things, constant. Nonstop. And so there's, and I think it's, you know, as we've talked about with some of the trust stuff as well, it reflects some of the other things going on in society, of whether you call it the culture wars or things like that. The fact is, you know, people are on these platforms battling, and journalists are seen as a good target for targeted harassment or for going after because we have the blue check mark, because we have the larger platform. And so this is a byproduct also of this universe that we're in. I mean, we have an internal security team at BuzzFeed that, you know, it goes through they have a process of, we've had enough of our writers getting harassed that they have a process of like, all right, here are the things we're going to do to sort of make sure you can't get doxxed, and we're going to do this and that. And that's where it's at now. So it is a factor. And I think it's something that's come out of this environment for sure.
I think here too, I'm not a journalist. I mean, I've obviously worked in the news space for a long time, including in editorial roles, but I don't consider myself a journalist. But I think here too, we're living in a very dangerous environment, right? We've got populist governments, we've got people calling out the press, calling out people to attack the press. But that's why we have to step back and say, well, how do we present ourselves? Right, the other night there was a White House Correspondents' Dinner, and I went, really? Now, I have no qualms with what Michelle Williams said. She had every right to say it. It's not about Michelle Williams. I'm saying, here we go. We get a stage to actually talk about the values of the press. And that's the way we use it, to talk about the values of the press? Right? I mean, does that make any sense? It doesn't make much sense to me. So, you know, how do we present the profession? How do we help people understand the value of what we do? How do we call out others who are misusing the profession? Now, again, these are personal views, not Google views, but I think these are important questions that we need to consider in this regard. You know, I can't step back and not question everything.
And I'm going to jump in as well because, you know, I'm from a generation of journalists where the danger was going to a war zone, and you have to get special training and like that you didn't at one point, but you do now. And I was talking to a friend the other day who spent a lifetime covering wars in all sorts of places, and she was telling me about her daughter who works out of New York and has a whole new security protocol because of her coverage, because of exactly of what's going on in the United States right now and how, like, online threats and how that manifests in physical threat. It is another world that way that has to be looked at, and organizations are looking at it. They have to. Any closing thoughts?
Just to clarify, because I forgot the transition, the Enlightenment, post-Enlightenment. Enlightenment was all about text and rationality, and post-Enlightenment is a shift to images instead of text and emotions, which you can see on around us everywhere increasingly.
Mine would be simply this. I mean, again, we're in a dramatically different environment where really the core question is, you know, how do democracies survive and thrive in a world of unfettered free expression? It's not a it's a paradox, and we have to figure that out. And the only thing I would encourage folks to do, as we all deal with these issues, with these challenges to our institutions, to our governments, is to think really carefully and deeply about potential solutions. Because my biggest fear in this environment is we're too quick to impose solutions without having an understanding of the secondary consequences. And I think the secondary consequences are vast. I remember, you know, I read a Daniel Ellsberg's latest book about nuclear war. And in it was what I thought was a fascinating concept from a sociologist by the name of William Osgood, who said this back in about 1950. He said, always understand that with technological change, every technology is developed with a specific purpose in mind, and it's obviously always done with good and positive intent. What we tend not ever to know immediately are the secondary consequences. It's what he calls the cultural lag. Right? And we are now in that cultural lag of understanding the consequences of the internet in our lives, in our societies. And obviously, that's a particular challenge. But in doing so, in engaging with that lag, is at the same time, let's be just very careful and rethink everything before we jump to a solution that may not be a solution at all.
Craig?
You know, the thing I would say, we talked about sort of the complexity and the scale of everything, but the simple thing for every person, if you're a journalist, think about what are you consuming on a daily basis? What judgments are you making based on that? And also pay attention to the stuff that is flowing to you and being shown to you by algorithms and platforms. And think about that, because we have to be very conscious of those kind of systems and what's being fed to us and also what we then feed out. And I think for the average person, you know, you should demand high standards from journalists. And you should report errors when you see them. And you should also think about what are you seeing and what are you consuming. We all now have more responsibility to really think about what we're consuming, where it's coming from. We have to make more effort on a cognitive level and on other levels to actually look at this and pay attention to it. And it can be kind of an interesting thing to actually sit and really look at your search results and your news feed and ask yourself, why am I being shown these things? And if we're all a little bit more conscious of that and also about the stuff that we like or engage with, how that actually sends signals out there to potentially show it to more people, then we start to contribute to good stuff spreading rather than bad stuff.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. I'm going to bring Natalie Turvey up.
My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm executive director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. Trust and misinformation are huge issues for journalism, for the news industry, and for the platforms. Trust is the foundation on which journalism is built. And to quote Craig Newmark, founder of Craigslist and one of the original funders of the Trust Project, he spoke recently at a conference and said, a trustworthy press is the immune system of our democracy. So on behalf of the CJF, I'd like to thank Hossein, Richard, and Craig for being with us in Toronto to share their insights on how news outlets and platforms can optimize for trust and can increase public confidence in the news. And thank you to the always smart and fabulous Anna Maria Tremonti for the work she put into making this a timely and relevant conversation and one we can all benefit from. Please join me in a round of applause for our speakers. I'm also delighted we could bring some spring weather for Richard. When he's not traveling, he's based in California, where they've had a cold snap. It's in the 50s, about 14 degrees. So there are breezes that are breezes strong enough to ruffle hair, and I think people are wearing two hoodies to work, Richard. But before we head into the cocktail reception, I have the briefest CJF preview to share some of our upcoming events. We hope you'll join us. So tomorrow is May 3rd, and we are spearheading our first ever World News News Day. In conjunction with World Press Freedom Day, we're celebrating and highlighting the power of journalism. There are actions taking place around the world, and there's an event in Montreal pour la Journée Mondiale de l'Information, and our first inaugural News Day event at the CBC Atrium. Please do come and join us. Ian Hennemansing is our host, and we have a lineup of some of Canada's top journalists from all the media outlets. But more importantly, we have the people at the center of vital news stories who will speak firsthand to the power of journalism and how it changed their lives and their communities. Richard is with us again for an Ask Google Anything. He's a brave man to do that with our audience. And we also have some amazing Canadian musical talent performing to support our cause, and including a Polaris Prize winner, Lido Pianmenta. So this event is open to the public, and we do hope you join us. On May 24th, we welcome Lara Satrakian on Fixing News and Newsroom Culture. Satrakian is the co-founder of News Deeply, and she was among the five women to come forward with sexual harassment allegations by political journalist Mark Halperin while he was at ABC News. And on June 14th, we're celebrating excellence in journalism in Canada and abroad at the CJF Annual Awards Gala. We have Robin Doolittle as our host this year, and along with our hosts, along with our awards and fellowships for young and seasoned journalists, we pay tribute to joint Pulitzer Prize winners Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey of the New York Times, along with Ronan Farrow for their bombshell reporting on Harvey Weinstein, which led to a flood of women and men coming forward to speak about sexual harassment and assault and power dynamics in the workplace. You can have a look at our website and social media feeds for details on our upcoming events. And our thanks to all of you for joining us and for supporting the work of the CJF. I would like to now invite you to join us in the next room for a cocktail reception to meet our speakers and continue this conversation. Thank you.